So let's do a little recap here. Lesson one recap. Remember, we did kind of a big narratival. Where are we? You are here. X marks the spot. So God creates man for communion with him. Man, of course, rebels and is expelled from the presence of God. Which direction were they exiled out of the garden?
Eastward.
Eastward, yeah, out of the east side, yeah. God calls one man through whom he would restore this communion. Abraham calls him out of the nations. God's people are enslaved in Egypt, so the chosen seed through Abraham are enslaved. God redeems his people out of slavery, purchases them, and brings them to the wilderness. God gives instruction for the tabernacle to Moses. Of course, they build the tabernacle, all of the implements. And then at the end of Exodus, we have God filling the tabernacle. But Moses could not approach the tabernacle because the glory of the Lord had filled it. So that was the kind of narratival structure there. Any thoughts upon that before we proceed? We've been over that a couple times now. So there's just certain themes that will keep popping out as we're going through this. As we were going through that, the idea of wilderness hit me a little bit there, because there's this sense of wilderness where God redeems the people out of Egypt, but he brings them to the wilderness. And that idea of wilderness is it's a place of desolation, a place of chaos, a place where God doesn't really commune with his people in the wilderness, right? He has to bring them in to do that. And so he saves his people, takes them out to the wilderness, and then obviously gives them the tabernacle instructions, which is which is built in the wilderness, and which is sort of the center of that relationship. Okay, then we had some other definitions that I kind of wanted to have us keep in mind as we're going through this. So there was the categories of unclean and clean, and we looked at some of those scriptures. Right, so the nations are considered unclean. The people of Israel were considered clean if they were properly atoned for, in a sense. So if they had been, you know, doing their sacrifices and that sort of thing, they would be considered part of the clean. And there's also the difference between common and holy. And we see this in the tabernacle worship quite often. Holy is usually referencing that which is set apart for a specific purpose. We're going to see this today when we get to chapter 3 with the grain offering. It speaks of it as a most holy offering. So we'll see what that means. Then there's this idea of moral uncleanness. So we're talking about sin at that point, right? So you have committed a trespass, you have robbed someone, you have lied, you have made a rash oath. Right? These are sins. And this idea of intentional sin, which we see in that passage in Numbers that we read, intentional sin was, for the most part, not meant to be what was being atoned for in the sacrificial system. The sins that are referenced, especially once we get to chapter 4 with the sin offering, chapter 5 with the sin offering, are generally considered to be unintentional sins. Sins that you commit while going about your business. You know, I shouldn't have said that was incorrect, or I've misspoken, or I've treated my neighbor poorly. These are the types of sins that this sacrificial system is meant to atone for. There's no description of what to do after you murder someone. You don't come and bring this type of animal and sacrifice it in this way. There was no forgiveness of sin for those types of sins. And a lot of those would have had capital punishments assigned to them for that reason. Which is where we get this idea of being cut off, right? So if you had committed one of these types of sins, there was no chance of redemption or atonement for those sins. You would be cut off from the people and separated from the clean, right? You would be cast into the unclean. Yes?
Yeah, I've been wondering about that cut off expression.
Yeah.
You see it many times.
Yes, you do, yeah.
So does that mean they send them away from their cities, or?
It generally meant, yeah, you would be treated as a Gentile. You would be cast out. And in some senses, it probably would have meant capital punishment as well.
What was the question there?
She asked what the what we're talking about when we say cut off.
Right.
So these are the kind of categories we need to have in mind. Along with this moral uncleanness, there's also a ceremonial uncleanness, which we're going to see in some of the sacrifices here. Things that you could do that weren't necessarily like a moral sin, but would make you unfit for being part of the worship of the congregation or entering into the tent of meeting, the tabernacle area. So the burnt offering summary. This is kind of where we ended off last time. We went through the burnt offering and looked at a lot of the aspects of it. So a burnt offering was an offering for a person to be accepted before the Lord. You remember that? The person would offer it so that they could be accepted before Yahweh. It was an offering of clean or blameless, without blemish, domesticated animals. They would be male, and they would be of varying values, so you have the different sort of range of livestock that could be offered there. Remember, when you couldn't offer a wild animal, even though some of the wild animals could be eaten, they could be clean, they couldn't be offered as sacrifices. And of course, none of the unclean animals could be offered. The animal is designated for the purpose of atonement, or covering, or appeasing, or ransoming. The animal was killed by the one who brought it. So remember, if you brought the animal to the entrance of the tent of meeting, you had to be the one that killed it. Now then, after you had killed it, the priest would perform the rites with it. So the priest would take the blood, and the blood would be applied to the altar where the burnt offering was burned. That's the only thing that was done with the blood, with the burnt offering. Now, there's a couple things we're going to get to, probably not today, but chapters 6 and 7 elaborate on all of these and give some extra details that you don't see here. So, in the burnt offering, not all of it is burnt. So the skin, for instance, is not burnt. The pelt, right? The pelt was kept separated and kept for the priest. But we'll see that when we get to chapter 6. There's going to be some of that stuff with these other sacrifices, too. That it's almost like for the first 5.5-6 chapters, you're getting the description of what happens according to the perspective of the person who's bringing the offering. And then in chapters 6 and 7, you get more elaboration on the duties of the priests, what they're supposed to do with these offerings. So let's turn to chapter 2, Leviticus chapter 2, and we'll start going through the grain offering.
Shall be of fine flour. Ye shall pour oil on it, and put frankincense on it, and bring it to Aaron's sons, the priests. And he shall take from it a handful of the fine flour and oil, with all of its frankincense, and the priest shall burn this as its memorial portion on the altar, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. But the rest of the grain offering shall be for Aaron and his sons. It is a most holy part of the Lord's food offering. When you bring the grain offering baked in the oven as an offering, it shall be unleavened loaves of fine flour mixed with oil, or unleavened wafers smeared with oil. grain offering baked on a griddle. It shall be of fine flour unleavened, mixed with oil. You shall break it in pieces and pour oil on it. It is a grain offering. And if your offering is a grain offering cooked in a pan, it shall be made of fine flour with oil. And you shall bring the grain offering that is made of these things to the Lord. And when it is presented to the priest, he shall bring it to the altar. And the priest shall take from the grain offering its memorial portion and burn this on the altar, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. And the rest of the grain offering shall be for Aaron and his son. It is a most holy part of the Lord's food offerings. No grain offering that you bring to the Lord shall be made with leaven. For you shall burn no leaven nor any honey as a food offering to the Lord. As an offering of first fruits, you may bring them to the Lord, but they shall not be offered on the altar for a pleasing aroma. You shall season all your grain offerings with salt. You shall not let the salt of the covenant with your God be missing from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt. If you offer a grain offering of first fruits to the Lord, you shall offer for the grain offering of first fruits fresh ears roasted with fire, crushed new grain. And you shall put oil on it and lay frankincense on it. It is a grain offering. And the priest shall burn as its memorial portion some of the crushed grain and some of the oil with all of its frankincense. It is a food offering to the Lord.
Anything stand out immediately that's different from the burnt offering?
Salt.
Salt, yes. But that kind of makes it sound like they should be putting salt on the burnt offering too, doesn't it? With all of your offerings, you shall offer salt.
No blood.
Well, there's no blood, that's right. There's nothing to anoint the altar with. Yeah, that's a good observation.
Only a portion of the offering is consumed, not all of it,
right.
And the rest goes to the priest.
That's right. So a handful is taken out and burned, and the rest is given to the priest. Whereas the burnt offering, nobody's eating anything on that. On this one, the priest is given this portion. All right, that's some good observations. Well, let's go through it. So, verse 1, the grain offering in Hebrew is called a mincha. That's the term used for that. It's a gift of grain. And it shall be of fine flour. This term, fine flour, is referring to, actually people debate what this means, but it's basically the inner part of the kernel of wheat. So you're not getting any husk, you're not getting any germ, or any other part of the wheat. It's the inner, finest part that can be ground up very, very finely. So it's not just any old wheat. It's very nice. It's the best wheat you would use, best flour you would use. Also, oil and frankincense are put on the pile. You would bring, I guess, a pile of this flour. They would put oil and frankincense on it. The person doing the offering would bring these things and put it on. Does anybody know what frankincense is, by the way? It's a resin, yeah. So they take trees and they slit the bark, and the resin comes out like pine sap. You know how you see on pine trees that amber coming out? And so that's gathered, and it is used for all sorts of ceremonial purposes. It is edible, partly. If you eat too much of it, it's not good for you. But if some of it got in the flour and they ate it, it's not going to hurt them. Probably tastes pretty good, actually. Smells good. So then the priest would grab that portion that had the frankincense on it and a lot of the oil. They're going to grab that out, and that's what's going to be burned on the altar. This term, burned here, we're going to run into this a lot. It's the same verb that's used for burning incense. And it's the same root where we get the word incense in Hebrew. So you're actually, what you're doing is you're converting it to smoke, essentially. The flour, the frankincense, is being basically used as an incense. It's being burned as incense, converted to smoke, which goes up. There's other words in Hebrew for burn. None of them are used of these offerings, in any of these offerings, except one exception that we'll make it to today. So the aroma is pleasing to the Lord. Now, we're anthropomorphizing here, right? God doesn't have nostrils. He can't smell the frankincense. But this is pleasing to the Lord. There's something about what is being done here that is pleasing to him. And, of course, from our perspective, it would actually smell pretty good. Right? You're burning this flower, you're burning this frankincense. So there's kind of a correlation there. You're able to, with your own senses, sort of visualize how this could be pleasing to the Lord. Verse 3, the remainder of this offering is then given to the priests to eat. And they would have to prepare it and eat it. So it is a most holy portion of the offering. So we didn't see this with the burnt offering, right? Because the burnt offering is not eaten, right? There's nothing is consumed there. Any of the sacrifices that are consumed by the priest only have this designation as being most holy. In the next chapter, we're going to see something a little different. In the peace offering, the meal is actually shared between the priest and the person bringing it. It's not called a most holy because it's not designated for the priest, which is what has made this the most holy portion. It's the Lord's food offering. This term, food offering, is in all of these chapters. So all of these offerings that are burnt, that are converted to smoke, are considered the Lord's food offering, which is why we also see this pleasing aroma language is used to describe them. So the offering can be baked or cooked in advance. You could bring these offerings before, or cook them before, and bring them. In case you didn't want to travel with uncooked flour, I'm not exactly sure why there would be a difference here, but perhaps it was bringing something prepared, which you know the priests are going to eat, and maybe take some of the burden off of them. Or perhaps because of the labor that's involved, there's a sense of offering something to God that you have actually labored over and prepared for him. Verse 4, the grain offering may contain no leaven. And leaven is, well, I think we all know what leaven is. It's an agent, it's a living microbe or organism that is going to actually eat the thing you put it in and have the byproduct of creating all sorts of things. It would be used for alcohol, it would be used for making bread rise. So nothing like that is to be offered with any of these sacrifices. And smeared with oil. The ones that are brought are to be smeared with oil. Obviously, grain doesn't have fatty portions, right? There's no fat that's going to burn. But there still has to be something flammable in there. And there's something about oil itself, and we see it in the setting up of the tabernacle. The oil is used to do all sorts of priestly rites. And so oil is a big part of the temple, the tabernacle is worshipped here. Verses 5 through 8. So if you do bring the pre-made stuff, these are given to the priests who present them at the altar before the Lord. The food offering portion is burned, and the rest is taken by the priest. So same as with the pile of flour you bring. If you bring the prepared loaves, then they are split between the portion that is burned and the portion that is given to the priests. Later on it says how much the portion is supposed to be. It's, I believe it was roughly 2 liters of flour, I think would be the grain offering. So, you know, that'd be 8 cups of flour. And so the priest would grab their portion. So they're taking about 10% of it and burning it, and the rest is given. So no leaven lemons or anything sour or fermented or honey shall be burned on the altar, but these could be donated as first fruits offerings to the Lord. So if you had already made some loaves with leaven or baked something with honey or a nectar, that word honey could be used for both. It's usually describing bee honey, but it could also be used for a date, or the nectar from a date or something like that, which people could use to sweeten breads and do that. But you wouldn't burn any of that stuff, right? You would bring it. That could be offered as a first fruits offering, which would be then given to the priests. But you were not permitted to burn that on the altar. And verse 13, salt is to be offered with all offerings. There's a lot of speculation about kind of what this is all about. The salt that's to be offered. I'm of the opinion that this is referring to, well, it says the salt of the covenant, right? And so it's describing something about the covenant. And salt being a preservative, salt being something that is valuable, I think it's referring to the fact that the covenant is everlasting, and that as a result, you are to offer this perpetually with your sacrifices. The salt is supposed to mimic the character of the covenant being perpetual. And then finally, there was the section about the whole grains. Oh, yes, Robert.
Just something on the salt. I heard someone teach this. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's in the Middle Eastern cultures, and this goes back many centuries, if you invited a guest into your house and shared a meal with them, you now had, as the host, had to offer protection for the guest. So, and that protection was offered the moment salt was introduced in the meal. Then it basically was the meal is official. I don't know if then this means that the covenant is official when the salt is introduced.
Yeah, I would hesitate to kind of take local traditions and kind of superimpose them, because we may not know precisely about those traditions, but there could be something there. I think it's more likely has something to do with the preservative effect, and with the animal sacrifices, the salt could also have the added benefit of removing more of the blood from the flesh. So when you salt meat, like the blood runs out. So there could be something more along those lines, but there's not a lot of reference to this in Scripture. We hear salt of the covenant is referenced a couple times in referring to the covenant that God made with David and for his house to carry on forever, right? I should have written down that reference. Is it Ahijah who is defending Davidic throne, and he uses this term salt of the covenant to say why the northern kingdom shouldn't have rebelled. They should have stuck with the house of David.
Second Chronicles 13:5.
Okay, so yeah, let's go there actually. summary of the grain offering. All grain offerings contain oil, either mixed in with the flour or smeared on top. All unbaked or unprepared grain or flour contains frankincense. So there's an element of a sweet-smelling incense there. No leaven or honey shall be burned on the altar. And the purpose of this is for provision for the priests as well as thanksgiving from the one offering the gift. People are, when they're offering grain, they're offering something that they've labored for. It costs them money. It costs them time. And so they're bringing something that is of value to them to show thankfulness and to offer provision for the priests. And all offerings contain the salt of the covenant. This offering, unlike the burnt offering, is called the most holy offering because it's eaten only by the priests. All right, any thoughts before we move on to chapter 3? Yeah.
Why do we no longer burn frankincense?
Some people do.
Right.
I mean, it smells nice. I have a frankincense candle at home that I burn at Christmas time, and I love it. But for ceremonial purposes, we don't burn. That's just not part of Christian worship to actually burn these things. So, I mean, all of these sacrifices we're looking at here have been fulfilled. And so we no longer practice them like they did. This was for the people of Israel for a time, and so we aren't those people, and we don't worship God in this way or approach Him in this way. Again, I've been hesitating to like, why don't we all want to go to the Book of Hebrews and read some stuff? But I'm hesitating to go there too soon. I want to get through this stuff first before we start applying it. Has anybody ever been to like an Orthodox church where you walk in and just the wave of incense hits you? When I lived in Jerusalem, I would go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre whenever we had visitors and just take them on a tour or whatever. It's thick. It's really thick. Like you walk in and it's just like a wall of smoke. It certainly lets you know you're in a place that is considered sacred. You feel like you're being transported into a place that is not common, which definitely would have been happening here. Although in the tabernacle, this is outdoors, it would have been dispersing pretty quickly, but you probably still would have smelled it. All right, let's read chapter 3. Leviticus chapter 3.
He shall remove the whole fat tail, cut off close to the backbone, and the fat that covers the entrails, and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them at the loins, and the long lobe of the liver, that he shall remove with the kidneys. And the priest shall burn it on the altar as a food offering to Yahweh. If his offering is a goat, then he shall offer it before Yahweh, and lay his hand on its head, and kill it in front of the tent of meeting, and the sons of Aaron shall throw its blood against the sides of the altar. Then he shall offer from it, as his offering for a food offering to Yahweh, the fat covering the entrails, and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them at the loins, and the long lobe of the liver, that he shall remove with the kidneys. And the priest shall burn them on the altar, as a food offering with a pleasing aroma. All fat is Yahweh's. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations, in all your dwelling places, that you eat neither fat nor blood.
Anything strike you?
Now there's male and female.
Male and female animals, yeah. Tyler?
I was just wondering, in the 3-1 it always says from the herd.
Yep.
I don't know if I missed it at any point, but did you ever distinguish between the flock and the herd?
I was about to. I can do the thing.
Wonderful.
Herd would be the bigger animals, like bulls and things like that. The flock is the sheep and the lambs and smaller livestock. It's usually how it's distinguishing between those two.
So this would be like cattle.
That would be cattle of some sort, yeah. Larger livestock. The more expensive ones. And you see this kind of pattern, right? You're going from more expensive to less expensive. We'll see it even later when it gets to turtle doves and things like that for poor people.
And this always is opposed to like wild animals too, because you're not allowed to bring.
No, that's so. When you're talking herd, you're talking something domesticated.
Domesticated.
Good question. Good observation. Yeah.
Domesticated and clean.
And clean. Yeah. Although they would not have domesticated unclean animals.
Until you see people farming pigs in the New Testament.
Yes, which they shouldn't be doing. But when I lived in Israel, they did farm pigs for the goys, for us. But they farmed them on a platform, so they weren't actually on the land.
Oh.
Yeah, keep kosher, right? Anything else?
Now we have blood.
All right, so we've got some blood. Now, there was blood with the burnt offering. It was also thrown. But yes, we've got blood. Is there anything done with the blood? Did you notice?
What's the speech?
Yep, it's put on the sides of the altar. All right. Anything else? That last verse caught me when I first read this. So used to the Levitical or the Old Testament law about not eating blood that I'd never seen that before. No fat either. Now we're going to get to what that means. It doesn't mean you can't have a steak with some marbling in it. You don't have to drain all the fat off the meat before you eat it. But a particular portion of the fat. Okay, so let's go through this here. So this sacrifice, I don't think I made this distinction, this definition yet. When you see the word sacrifice here, this is different than the word offering. So we often use these words interchangeably, but offering is korban, like we talked about with the burnt offering. Also where you get that korban rule of the New Testament, right? Sacrifice is zevah, which was only used to describe this sacrifice. All of the other sacrifices are called offerings. And the offerings are slaughtered or killed, as is this one, but this one is called a zevah sacrifice. And so the distinction is that the zevah is eaten by the priest and the person that brings it. So it's a shared meal together. Right, again, has to be without blemish. Next week, I'm going to I've been building a document that's like a word cloud document with all of these kind of keywords and some of their synonyms and alternate meanings. This word, without blemish, blameless, right? Noah was a man blameless. sort of thing. It means sort of perfect, complete. Somebody that, you know, if you're missing a finger, you are not blameless because you are not complete, not whole. So the animal has to be whole and without blemish. So you're not singling out anybody in the room as missing fingers. Should have picked another. So the person who is bringing the offering will lean on the head of the animal and kill it. The priest doesn't get to kill it for you. You have to kill it. And of course this happens at the entrance to the tent of meeting. Over and over, at the entrance to the tent of meeting, before the Lord, at the entrance to the tent of meeting. They're always, this is as far as you get to go, right? You are approaching Yahweh. You're coming to the entrance of his, of the meeting place, the dwelling place, and this is how you are accepted. The priests throw or scatter the blood on the sides of the altar. Sprinkle, did you say sprinkle? It's spray. It's something that's going to disperse the blood evenly. They're not just sort of slowly dripping it down the side. They're throwing it, they're scattering it on the sides. This word could also be used to sow seed. Sowing seed in a field, you're spreading it out. Again, we have this, definition of it being a food offering. And you are burning, in this offering, you're burning the kidneys, the liver, and all of the fat. So, again, fat doesn't mean the marbling inside the meat. This is the big chunks of fat that cover things, like when we have our brisket every year, and there's that big cap of fat on top there. That's what we're talking about, the big chunks of fat. These were not permitted for people to eat. These were for Yahweh. That's the choice portion, right? The choice parts are given to Yahweh. Sorry, I shouldn't say priests. I think I was thinking something and writing at the same time. So the priest burns or converts to smoke the sacrifice. They're treating the meat like it's a piece of incense. They're converting it into this smoke, which goes up. Also, this was something that caught my eye and something that's interesting. The sacrifice is burned on top of the burnt offering. Right? Verse 5, it says, on top of the burnt offering. So you are probably doing this after bringing your burnt offering. You've brought a burnt offering, and now you're offering a peace offering. And it is likewise a pleasing aroma to the Lord. So this is designated as a peace offering, right? That's all the headings in our Bible say laws for peace offerings. The word connotates well-being. So, you know, if you're in a good relationship with someone, you have peace with them. You are in a relationship that is well between two people. So this offering is meant to be a symbol of the well-being between the person offering it and Yahweh. Anything we haven't seen in any of these yet? In all three of these sacrifices so far? We get all the way through three chapters and there's a specific word we haven't seen yet. Or specific concepts.
Atonement.
Pardon me?
Atonement.
Atonement, right? Haven't seen atonement. Haven't seen the word sin or forgiveness. In one it does say.
Yeah. For forgiveness or
no? Atonement, yeah. But this concept of offering, we kind of flatten everything out so that
everything
is about forgiveness of sin. I did something wrong, I have to bring an animal. It wasn't like that. And so you're bringing, and we're going to see an expansion of this peace offering later on too. It's also used for offerings of thanksgiving, vow offerings. If you're making a vow, you would present this offering. And so not every offering is meant to atone for your sin or to be forgiven. So the sacrifice of the peace offering maybe male or female from the flock as well as from the herd. Not everybody's got a herd. You know, some people only have smaller animals. But of course, it has to be blameless. And it was the same procedure that was used for the herd animals. Right? So the fat, the liver, the kidneys, those are burned, and the rest of the animal is eaten. If it is a goat, she-goat or young goat is the term used here, it's again the same procedure as the other things. And again, all of the fat, that's the word chenev, the choice portion of the meat belongs to the Lord. Same, this word for fat or choice portions is also the same root as the word for milk. And verse 17, we saw this and mentioned it already, but neither fat nor blood are to be eaten. And this, I don't think this is just referring to during this sacrificial ceremony, because it says it shall be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwelling places that you eat neither fat nor blood. And so it's talking about the fat the same way it talks about consuming blood, which they were never supposed to eat.
Does that trickle down to practical application for us in this time? I mean, we wouldn't eat blood. Or perhaps the
Yeah, I
think that is in drained blood.
I don't think there's a prohibition against us having any blood, so I don't think there'll be a prohibition against the fat either. I don't like the taste of blood. Any thoughts on that question? The question was: are we also prohibited? Is there any practical application to this? Fat and blood prohibition was.
Like a rare state.
Rare state, yeah. I guess this you're asking more like.
More like drained blood. Like if we were to, kill an animal and drain the blood, and then for whatever weird health benefits, you might want to drink it. Probably.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I think if you really wanted to drink blood, maybe there's something wrong. Because there are a lot of associations between that sort of activity and pagan cults and that sort of thing. Yeah, Robert?
Just for like rare steaks and stuff like that, you're actually not eating blood even though it looks like you are, because blood would coagulate and change at 42 degrees, and even rare steaks are higher than that, so the blood that you, what you think is blood is actually myoglobin, which is protein that is broken down from the meat. It's not blood at all. But the French do mix blood with the other condiments to make sauces.
The British have blood sausages.
Yeah.
It's like pudding.
A thickening agent.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. All the Slavic countries have that. As a kid, I ate blood sausage. I saw how my mom prepared it. And as a kid, we even fried blood in the frying pan. Like pancakes. I do remember you do that. As I understand it now, blood is not digestible. Maybe that's just human blood, not digestible. Like if you bite your tongue and you swallow some of your own blood, you're not going to digest it. But I don't know what happened. I don't remember ever having any issues. Nobody ever complained about eating blood sausage. Germans still do it.
There is in the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15, where James actually, at the apostles, write a letter to the Gentiles, and one of the things that they told them to do in verse 29 was to abstain from consuming blood.
Okay.
As well. But
I stand corrected.
But is that just so that they can live in peace and harmony with Jewish believers, or is that something that's applied to us specifically today?
I don't know. I don't want to just...
Could you repeat the question? Sorry.
The question, or the comment was that in the Jerusalem Council,
yes.
The Gentiles were told to abstain from eating blood.
Yes.
So, yeah, I stand corrected is what I said.
strangled blood, and something else.
That was one of the points I was going to make. So, three things, not a prescription. First point, with regards to blood, not having blood actually is part of the Noahic covenant. So he starts over there saying life is in the blood, and you should not consume it, so it's actually pre-Israelite. And we see it as post-Israelite also in Acts chapter 15.
Right.
So there's something to note over there with regards to blood. Second thing is the question about application. We can't turn off everything we learned in our previous lessons also with regards to application. First of all, application, we can't insert ourselves into a text and then say, does this apply to us, right? So one of the things to be careful about with regards to application is it's not a one-for-one. The application of this text is for a specific audience, which is the Israelites. They are not to have blood and not to have fat. Application does not lie in the mind of the reader. It lies in the mind of the author. The author of Leviticus had a specific audience in mind and a specific application in mind, which is don't have fat, don't eat blood for that purpose. Right? So that's very important that we keep that in mind. Otherwise, we can tend to be quite creative with our applications afterwards, which can make us believe things that the Bible isn't saying. So we have to be very careful about that. And the third thing to keep in mind also is blood has a specific role. Life is in the blood. Now, the biblical story has the point that life doesn't come through consuming blood. Life comes through the seed of the woman, who will give up his life so that those who believe in him will have life. And so those who try to consume blood, right, can never get life by consuming blood. So that's the big point over here. The big point over here is life does not come to you by consuming blood. We know that blood is in, life is in the blood, but no one can get life by consuming blood. Life in the biblical story is by the seed of the woman giving up his life for those that will trust in him. And so that's the biggest point I think we're to take from the narrative. Because later we're going to have other texts where if someone is bleeding, right, they're unclean. Why are they unclean? Because life is leaving them. It's death. Right? Anyone who touches a person who is bleeding will also be considered unclean because blood coming out equals death.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think when we read it in that context, blood shouldn't be consumed because we don't get life by trying to reverse the process by consuming life. Right? We get life.
You see a lot of pagan rituals.
Yes.
Yeah.
But we get life by the Lord actually sacrificing the seed of the woman so that we get access back to his presence.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. That was the end of the peace sacrifice. So, the summary, the choice portions and organs are burned, converted to smoke. The animal is eaten by the priests and the one bringing the sacrifice, so it's a shared meal between the holy priest and the one doing it. And the sacrifice of peace was a holy meal. And so this was, I guess you could see this as a way of somewhat partaking in this relationship that the priests would have had as the holy people. Like the ones that could go, they could go behind the tent, behind the curtain, or sorry, into the tent. They couldn't go behind the veil, but they could at least go into the holy duties. And they come out, and now they are communing with the people. And that's as close as you can get at this point. All right, I don't know how much.
Yeah, we got time to start another chapter here.
Okay, let's start the sin offering. Chapter 4, and this goes through in the Hebrew Bible, this is chapter 4. In the English Bible, it's 4 through chapter 5, 13. The chapters are a little different. Let's not read just the whole thing just yet. Maybe I'll read through verse 12, and we'll see if we can get through that. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, saying, if anyone sins unintentionally in any of the Lord's commandments about things not to be done, and does any one of them, if it is the anointed priest who sins,
thus bringing guilt on the people, then he shall offer for the sin that he has committed a bull from the herd without blemish to the Lord for a sin offering. He shall bring the bull to the entrance of the tent of meeting before the Lord, and lay his hand on the head of the bull, and kill the bull before the Lord. And the anointed priest shall take some of the blood of the bull, and bring it into the tent of meeting. And the priest shall dip his finger in the blood, and sprinkle part of it 7 times before the Lord, in front of the veil of the sanctuary. And the priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of fragrant incense before the Lord. That is in the tent of meeting. And the rest of the blood of the bull he shall pour out at the base of the altar of burnt offering that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And all the fat of the bull of the sin offering he shall remove from it, the fat that covers the entrails, and all of the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them at the loins, and the long lobe of the liver that he shall remove with the kidneys, just as these are taken from the ox of the sacrifice of the peace offerings. And the priest shall burn them on the altar of burnt offering. But the skin of the bull and all its flesh, with its head, its legs, its entrails, and its dung, all the rest of the bull he shall carry outside the camp to a clean place, to the ash heap, and shall burn it up on a fire of wood. On the ash heap it shall be burned up. Lots of different stuff here. All right, so what do we got?
Inside the temple.
Right. So what's happening inside the tent of meeting? What's he doing in there?
Seven times
it's sprinkled, and then it's placed on the altar of incense. Interesting. So this, and who is this? Who is this that's sin?
The anointed priest.
So it's not just any priest. This is the high priest. This is the. If you're the high priest and you sin, you are bringing guilt on the people of Israel. Right, verse 3. It is the anointed priest who sins. Thus bringing guilt on the people, then he shall offer. So this is something that the high priest has done that has brought guilt upon the people. You see a representation of the people by the priest. And so what is happening now is this blood is actually being brought inside the tent of meeting. Because he has sinned, that space needs to be cleansed. And that inner part of this of the tent of meeting needs to be cleansed. And so the blood is brought in to cleanse that place. Whereas when you or I, the common people, sin, we haven't defiled so much the inner part. We haven't defiled the other part. Yeah, Carrie?
And it knows there that it's unintentional.
Yes.
So not even, I guess, not even realizing or by mistake is the footnote.
Yeah, yeah. So it's the term, the way it's sort of worded in the Hebrew is like, as you're going about your business, you sin. You know, you're just... doing something, and oh man, I made a mistake there. Not a high-handed sin. This isn't planning some wickedness in character.
Could be a thought then,
right? Could be. It does go into a bit of detail later in this chapter as to what some of these sins could be. It describes them for the common people. I don't think we have time to continue on from there, but that's a couple of good observations on the difference. Glenn?
We have often as a Julius sacrifice.
Well, this one would be as often as the anointed priest has committed some offense.
Which would be daily, would it not?
You'd think if you're being scrupulous. today and give you thanks for your word. We thank you for the light that it brings us and for the knowledge that we can get from it. I pray, Lord, this morning as we contemplate these themes, as we contemplate this idea of blood and life, that we would be ever thankful for your sacrifice and for what you have done in atoning for us. Help us not to be complacent with the place we have in your plan here at this time in history, but help us to joyfully go about our days because we have been redeemed by your Son. Help us now as we go to worship. Help us to sing your praises and to sing thanks to you with joyful hearts. Help us to be humble as we hear your word read and preached, and help us to have thankfulness as we partake in your